Today's gospel comes from Matthew chapter 4. One of the things that makes it unique is that it's one of only two places in the gospels in which we read of an angel coming to Christ to strengthen him. It happens here in the last verse, and the other scene in which it happens in the gospels is also a Lenten moment. It happens in Luke chapter 22 in a passage that we know as the agony in the garden. While Christ is there, an angel comes to offer him strength. It's an overwhelming visual, in a sense. It's consoling in a way, because he's drawing strength, but it's also painful to imagine that Christ would suffer to such an extent that an angel would come to him to give him strength. I think at the same time, it's a powerful reminder. We go through very difficult experiences in life. We feel overwhelmed occasionally. As Christians, we should believe that it's possible in the difficulties of life that angelic assistance can find its way to us. And to take it a step further, I would say it's not only possible, it's something that we should expect, that in difficult moments of life, angelic strength can be granted to us. These are far from the only two instances in which angels are mentioned in the Bible, many instances in the Old Testament, also in the New. I have a question that I want you to formulate an answer to. How many times do you think angels are referenced in the New Testament? Think of an answer. At each Mass, I've gotten three responses to people. There's no prize. I don't have anything to offer. But if you feel really strong about a guess, just you can throw one out. They've been all over the board. Nobody's got it right so far. Does anybody want to offer just a thought? Across the Gospels, five, the Gospels, all the letters, Acts, the Apostles, Revelation, every book, we've got five. It's a lot of guesses. Okay. Somebody said 12, I think somewhere. Six. Okay. I'm not an auctioneer. What do you have? Okay, I thought you said something. Somebody said something really high. 300? That's the largest anybody's guessed. 158 times angels are referenced in the New Testament. That's a staggering number. It's not 300, but it's still very high. 158 times. It tells us that angels are appearing very often. It happens a lot in the Old Testament as well, too. And it's a lesson for us. The presence of angels is reality in our world. People are fascinated with angels. As a priest, it's something people like to discuss from time to time with me. Angel comes from a Greek word, angelos, means messenger. Oftentimes when angels appear in the Bible, they've got a particular message from God that they're passing along to someone. And sometimes the name of the angel is a part of the message. That's the case with my favorite angel. Believe it or not, Michael would be my favorite angel that I have. Michael's name in Hebrew is a question. It means, who can compare with God? Beautiful. Who can compare with God? It's a rhetorical question. It appears in a way in Revelation chapter 12. That's where Michael leads a host of angels in casting Satan and the falling angels out of heaven. That inspires, in part, the prayer to Saint Michael, some of you might be familiar with. We associate the fall of the angels, of the sin of Lucifer, with pride. There's a line in Proverbs 20 that inspires the phrase that we've heard, "Pride cometh before the fall." It's believed that at one point God revealed to all of the angels the plan of salvation history, what would transpire. And when Lucifer saw that Christ would be the redeemer of humanity, the hero of salvation history, he rebelled against the divine plan. So sometimes two Latin words, a brief phrase is associated with him, non serviam, I will not serve. It's emblematic in a way of Lucifer's rebellion against God's plan. Hence the fall. Pride cometh before the fall. There's a way in which this phrase, non serviam, weaves its way into our first reading, also into our gospel. If you think of the first reading, it comes from the end of Genesis chapter 2, beginning of Genesis chapter 3. And in that passage, the serpent doesn't say, don't serve. But there's a way that in what he proposes, he's inviting rebellion amongst Adam and Eve. If we think of Eden, we think of paradise. Adam and Eve dwell in communion, in harmony with God, but they also live in harmony with creation. So what the serpent invites is a type of rebellion into their lives. Breaks their communion, their harmony with God. Also breaks their harmony with creation itself. And the idea of the rebellion he proposes is not to serve, not to be a steward of God's plan, to be a rival of God, ultimately to replace God. And the consequences are tragic in that scene. It also has a way of weaving into the gospel. Matthew chapter 4, Christ finds himself in the desert, and when Satan tempts him, he doesn't say, "Don't serve, non serviam," but he does propose that Christ rebel against the will of the Father, against his mission, his plan, his purpose in being among us. Turn stones into bread, throw yourself from the parapet of the temple, bow down before me, worship me, don't serve. Give up the plan. Why should you serve the Father? Think of all this is going to cost you, the mission that you're taking on. Christ refuses the temptation, and we know from the Gospels that service is an enormously important part of how he understands his mission in the world. In Matthew 20, he tells the disciples, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." In Luke 22, there's a passage very much like it, and he says, "I am among you as one who serves." It's the way out, in a sense, of the temptation, acknowledging that his life is taking up, in a sense, in a mission of service. This is the case with our lives as well, especially when it comes to temptation. The best definition that I've ever come across for temptation came a number of years ago, and I think it's smashing. Just hits it beautifully. This is what a priest said to a group of seminarians. He said, "Temptation is the truth, twisted and used against us, which taken to its ultimate extreme is an attack on God." It's a fascinating line, a lot to think about there. The idea, I think, is that the enemy doesn't try to tempt us in arbitrary or random ways. There's a strategic attack that's made on us that involves twisting the truth that's in us, leading us away from God, rebelling, and then using what's twisted against us, which taken to its ultimate extreme, is an attack on God. Oftentimes, this is the way that temptation works, taking what is good and corrupting it, tarnishing it within us, we who are made in the image and the likeness of God. It's not a bad question to ask ourselves, here we are as Lent's beginning. Where can the truth be twisted in my life? Where, like Adam and Eve, can we begin to believe a lie about creation, the world, God, our place in the world? And where is truth? Where is the truth that's the foundation for life itself, for creation, for our lives, the truth that we build our lives upon? One way to think about it is in the last words of Christ in the gospel. His last reply to Satan is a reference to the first commandment. There he says, "You shall worship the Lord God alone, and him shall you serve." It's kind of fascinating. He uses the line "serve" when the enemy tempts him away from service. It's all built on the first commandment. You shall worship the Lord God alone, and him shall you serve. It reminds me in a little way, as a final image, of Michael's name. Who can compare with God? As Christians, it's good to acknowledge that beautiful question that Michael means. Who can compare with God? But also to begin to answer it and to acknowledge ultimately nothing, no one can compare with God.